One of their sons was proving to be a fiery radical, and reports of his behavior startled all Hawaii. In these years, Hawaii seemed filled with Hales and Whipples and Hewletts and Janderses and Hawksworths. In some classes at Punahou, 16 out of 24 students would bear these or related names. Only skilled genealogists tried to keep the bloodline straight, for Hales were Hawksworths and Hawksworths were Whipples, and fairly frequently a Hale would marry a Hale and thus intensify the complications, so that, in time, no child really understood who his various cousins were, and an island euphemism gained popularity. "He is my Calabash cousin," which meant that if one went back far enough, some kind of blood relationship could be established. Hawaii came to consider this Hale, Whipple, Hewlett, Janders, Hawksworth menage simply as the family, and to recognize its four salient characteristics. Its children went to Punahou, its boys went to Yale. Invariably, it found some kind of good-paying job for every son and for the husband of every daughter, and members of the family tried to avoid scandal. Therefore, when one of the boys became a radical, the family was deeply jolted. As long as he had stayed at Punahou, this renegade had done well, but this was not unusual, for the family expected its sons to prosper there. Take the case of Hawksworth Whipple, who gained international honors for his work on Polynesian history. He started his scholarly investigation while still at Punahou, although later he took his B.A. at Yale, his M.A. at Harvard, his Ph.D. from Oxford, and his D.Litt from the Sorbonne. He received honorary degrees from 11 major universities. But when he died in 1914, the Honolulu Mail announced simply, "The great scholar was educated at Punahou." None of the rest really mattered. In the year that the great scholar died, crowded with honors, the young member of the family who was to become the radical was graduating from Punahou. He was Hawksworth Hale, in all outward respects a typical 16-year-old boy. He was neither tall nor short, fat nor thin. His hair was not black, nor was it blonde, and his eyes displayed no single prominent color. He was not at the top of his class, nor yet at the bottom, and he was outstanding in no one scholastic accomplishment. He had played games moderately well, but had never won fistfights against boys larger than himself. Young Hawksworth Hale, named after the noted scholar, was most noted for the fact that he had uncommonly pretty sisters, Henrietta and Jerusha, and they lent him a spurious popularity which he would not otherwise have enjoyed. There was a good deal of chivying to see which of his friends would win the favors of the charming sisters, and of course in later years his younger sister became engaged to one of her Calabash cousins, a Whipple, whereupon Hawksworth's father told the family, "I think it's high time somebody married a stranger. Get some new blood into this tired old tree." His words were not taken in good grace, because he had married his cousin, a Hawksworth girl, and it was felt that he was casting aspersions upon her. Nevertheless, when his oldest daughter began displaying outward tendencies and actually became engaged to a man named Gage from Philadelphia, he expressed his pleasure. But later, Henrietta met a boy from New Hampshire named Bromley, and the two discovered that way, way back, her great-great-great-great-grandfather Charles Bromley and his great-great-great... Well, anyway, she felt a lot more congenial with Bromley than she ever had with her fiancé Gage, so she married the former, because, as she pointed out, he seems more like one of the family. When young Hawksworth Hale left Punahou, it was understood that he would go on to Yale, and in New Haven this undistinguished youth was to explode into a prominence no one had anticipated. Not having wasted his limited intellectual reserves in preparatory school, he was ready to blossom in college, and gradually became both a scholar and a polished gentleman. In his grades, he did markedly better than boys who had surpassed him at Punahou. While in sports, he captained the polo team and served as assistant manager of the basketball team. He acquired the lesser amenities, and in politics ran successfully for president of his class. It was this unlikely youth who became the radical. His commitment began one day in his junior year, when a Professor Albers from Leipzig was ending a lecture on the theory of imperialism with this shrewd observation. The Congregational Church, cum Boston Merchant, invasion and capture of Hawaii, is the exact counterpart of the Catholic Church, cum Paris entrepreneur rape of Tahiti. The proof of this analogy lies, I think, in the demonstrated manner whereby the missionaries who went to Hawaii, though they did not call in the American gunboats, as did their French cousins in Tahiti, nevertheless, by revolutionary means, stole the land from the Hawaiians and wound up possessors of the islands. Professor Albers' class contained, in addition to young Hawksworth Hale, his Calabash cousin Hewlett Janders, two Whipples, and a Hewlett. But these other descendants of the missionaries were content to stare in embarrassment at their armrests. Not so Hawksworth. He coughed once, coughed twice, then boldly interrupted, "Professor Albers, I'm sorry, but I'm afraid you have your facts wrong." "I beg your pardon," the German professor spluttered. "I mean that, whereas your facts on Tahiti may be correct, those on Hawaii are definitely in error." "Don't you stand when you address remarks to your professor?" the Leipzig-trained scholar demanded, growing red. When Hawksworth got to his feet, Albers referred to his notes and began quoting an impressive list of sources. The journals of Ellis, Jarvis, Bird, the researches of Amsterfield, de Gaulier, Whipple, they all tell the same story. "If they do," Hawksworth said, "they're all wrong." Professor Albers flushed and asked, "What is your name, young man?"
"Hawksworth Hale, sir."
"Well," Albers laughed, "your testimony on this matter is hardly unimpeachable." This contempt goaded Hale into making a reply that infuriated the professor. "You cited Jarvis. Have you ever read Jarvis?"
"I do not cite sources I have not read," Albers fumed.
"Jarvis happened to be a friend of some of my ancestors, and they held him in keen regard because he was the first impartial observer to defend the missionaries. And I read what he wrote, in the original papers in which he wrote it. And what he wrote, sir, simply doesn't support your thesis." The class broke up in something of a scandal, and for some weeks the word missionary had a curious force of its own at Yale. Professor Albers, goaded by his young tormentor, marshaled an impressive battery of anti-clerical critics, whose jibes at all churches and their nefarious skill in capturing the land of backward countries pleased the young iconoclasts of that day, and for several biting weeks the professor carried the day, and the dormitories rang with the famous jibes against the Hawaiian missionaries. They came to the island to do good, and they did right well. No wonder the islands were lighter when they left. They stole everything in sight. They taught the natives to wear dresses and sign leases. And most cutting of all, before the missionaries came to Hawaii, there were 400,000 happy, naked natives in the mountains, killing each other, practicing incest, and eating well. After the missionaries had been there a while, there were 30,000 fully clothed, miserable natives huddled along the shore, paying lip service to Christianity and owning nothing. In Professor Albers' classes, such lines of reasoning became increasingly popular. And for the first time, Yale, the source of missionaries, took a serious look at what they had really accomplished. In those exciting days, it was downright unpleasant to be a Whipple or a Hewlett. For the fact was often cited that Dr. John Whipple had abandoned the church to become a millionaire, and that Hewlett had left to steal land from the defenseless natives. In the fifth week of the intellectual investigation, Hawksworth Hale, then a junior, 19 years old, asked for time to read to the class the results of some work he had been doing on his account, and in cold, dispassionate phrases he developed this thesis. In the third decade of the last century, a series of little ships brought missionaries to Hawaii. There were 12 ships in all, bearing a total of 52 ordained missionaries,
brought to the islands at a cost of $1,220,000. At the end of nearly 30 years of religious and social service in the islands, the missionaries controlled practically no land, except in the case of one Abraham Hewlett, who had married a Hawaiian lady, and whose family lands have always been kept in her name for the welfare of her people. The Whipples owned no land whatever, nor did the Hales, except in later days, a few building lots on which their homes have been built. In fact, in 1854, the Hawaiian government took cognizance of the unfortunate position of the mission families and passed a special law allowing those who had served the islands well to buy small parcels of land at favorable prices. And the government did this, Professor Albers, because they were afraid not that the missionaries would take over the islands, but that they would go back to America and take their children with them. The minutes of the government on this matter are explicit. June 1851. The missionaries who have received and applied for lands have neither received nor applied for them without offering what they considered a fair compensation for them. So far as their applications have been granted, Your Majesty's government have dealt with them precisely as they have dealt with other applications for land. It will not be contended that missionaries, because they are missionaries, have not the same right to buy land in the same quantities and at the same prices as those who are not missionaries. But, besides what is strictly due to them, in justice and in gratitude for large benefits conferred by them on your people, every consideration of sound policy under the rapid decrease of the native population is in favor of holding out inducements for them not to withdraw their children from these islands. We propose a formal resolution declaring the gratitude of this nation to the missionaries for the services they have performed and making some provision to ensure that their children remain in these islands. At this point, Hawksworth looked directly at his professor and continued, "Dr. Albers, the provisions of this resolution were carried out, and the investigating committee found that the missionaries who had worked so long in Hawaii had acquired so little that the community as a whole applauded when the government provided that any missionary who had served in the islands for 8 years be allowed to buy 560 acres of government lands at a price of 50 cents an acre lower than what the average white newcomer would have to pay. Since the average price at that time was $1.45 an acre, this represents a reduction of exactly 34.5%, or 1% per year for arduous and faithful service. So far as I can find, the missionaries acquired land in absolutely no other way, and even so, most of them were then too poor to take advantage of the government's offer. Hawaii desperately wanted the mission families to stay in the islands, and it has been justly said that the most significant crop grown by the missionaries was not sugar, but their sons. Now, if you want to argue that the brilliant young mission sons who left Hawaii, studied here at Yale, and then returned to the islands, usurped a disproportionate number of important jobs in medicine, law, government, and management, you would be on good grounds. But if you do so argue, don't blame the missionaries. Blame Yale. I conclude that it is neither fair nor accurate to accuse these families of stealing land which they never came into possession of. It was the non-mission families, the New England Sea Rovers, who got the land. Then, the land having been obtained by these men, it is true that mission sons managed it for a fee, but would you have had it lie fallow? The facts you cite apply to Tahiti. They simply do not apply to Hawaii. He sat down, flushed with excitement, and expected the applause of his classmates for having dared argue with the arrogant professor. But what Hawksworth had said was not popular. It ran against the grain of the age and was not believed. Jokes about missionaries continued, and Hale saw that, whereas he had gained nothing with his contemporaries, he had placed himself at a serious disadvantage with the faculty. But what grieved him most was that his Punahou associates, Hewlett Janders and the others, felt rather ashamed that a subject which would have died with only momentary embarrassment had now been so thoroughly ventilated as to force all members of the class to be either anti-missionary or pro, and nearly everyone fell into the first category. And the Punahou men were infuriated that one of their own number had stirred up the mess. So Hawksworth Hale's first venture into public argument backfired rather badly. But his studies had disclosed to him his ancestors, so that no matter how witty the jibes against missionaries became, he knew what the facts were, and this knowledge, in the subtle way that knowledge has, fortified him in many ways and made him a stronger man. His preoccupation with researches into Hawaiian history developed an accidental concomitant which outraged all of Yale and led to his temporary withdrawal from the university. He was in the library one day, reading files of an early Honolulu newspaper, The Polynesian, for he wished to refresh his mind as to what that journal's excitable editor, James Jackson Jarvis, had actually said about missionaries. And for a while he got bogged down in the story of how Jarvis had protested when a French warship roared into Honolulu, insisting that French wines be imported in unlimited amounts, and of how the French authorities threatened to lash him through the streets with a cat o' nine tails. Next, he turned the yellowed pages to read of the time when the British consul actually did horsewhip poor Jarvis for defending Hawaii against British intrusions into local affairs, and he began to laugh to himself. Jarvis must have been a wild-eyed young man, like me. And the conceit pleased him, and he felt sympathy for the strange will-o'-the-wisp editor who had so befriended Hawaii and the missionaries, until he suddenly looked at the name again. James Jackson Jarvis. Hadn't he heard that name in another context? He hurried from the library and went to the exhibition hall where one of the glories of Yale University stood, the collection of early Italian masterpieces gathered together by a curious man named James Jackson Jarvis, who had lived in Florence in the 1850s. Hawksworth hurried into the gallery and walked among the strange, faraway gold and blue painting of an age he could not even begin to comprehend. He was unprepared to like the art he saw in the Jarvis collection, and he did not try to do so, for it was in no way similar to the work of Raphael and Rembrandt, which he had been taught was true art. But as he gazed at the affectionate little paintings, more than 100 of them, he sensed that they had been collected by someone who would love them, and he asked an attendant, "Who was this man Jarvis?" The man didn't know, so Hale sought out another, and finally the curator. Who was Jarvis? The curator had a brief memorandum on the forgotten donor and said, "An American writer on art who lived in Florence in the middle years of the last century, a close friend of Elizabeth and Robert Browning and John Ruskin, in his own way an eminent man and America's first writer on art." Did he ever live in Hawaii? No, but late in life he did write the first book in English on Japanese art. He discovered prints as art forms, so he must have lived in the Orient, although I have no knowledge of the fact. Hawaii isn't in the Orient, Hale explained. Isn't it considered part of Asia? No, Hale replied sharply, and left. In those days he did not think much of faculty members. He was puzzled. It seemed most unlikely that two men of such dissimilar natures as the rambunctious Hawaiian editor and the polished Italian art connoisseur could have been the same man. And yet there was the name, James Jackson Jarvis. So he continued his researches, and discovered at last that his Hawaiian Jarvis had failed to make a living with his Polynesian, and had fled in disgust to Florence, where he became the first great American collector of paintings, the first American art philosopher, and the first writer on Japanese aesthetics. He felt a proprietary interest in the strange man and thought, "That's not bad for a Hawaii boy." And then, as he looked into the peculiar circumstances whereby Yale acquired the Jarvis paintings, he became appalled at the unsavory tricks the college had used to steal them, and he forgot all about missionaries and began digging into the events of 1871, when the former editor of the Polynesian was 53 years old and in sore need of money. Yale had loaned him $20,000 on his paintings, and he had been unable to repay the debt, so the college put the entire collection up for public auction, 119 masterpieces in all, worth $70,000 or $80,000 then, over $1 million in 1917. But college authorities had quietly forewarned potential bidders that any buyer must take the entire collection in one lump, and the rumor had circulated that even if this were done, the college would not yield clear title to the pictures, so that any prospective buyer must beware of lawsuits. And on the day of the sale there were no bidders, and Yale acquired the collection for what Jarvis owed the college. "This is a scandal," Hawksworth cried. And to his amazement, he found himself deeply involved in art problems. And now, when he passed through the Jarvis collection, he thought, "These marvelous masterworks." He wrote a long letter to the college paper asking why a college with Yale's background should have conspired at such a nasty business, and hell broke loose. Hawksworth was defamed on the Yale campus as a radical who had raped the reputation of his own college. But a Boston art critic wrote, "The general outline of the facts so patiently developed by young Mr. Hale have long been known in art circles, but hitherto they have not been publicly aired, out of courtesy to a revered institution whose deportment otherwise has been above reproach." So, once more, one of the most essentially conservative young men Hawaii ever sent to Yale found himself the center of controversy, and this one far exceeded in general interest his spirited defense of the missionaries, for it involved the honor of the university itself. At the height of the controversy, the campus newspaper evolved a logical way for Hawksworth to apologize. But just as he had refused to accommodate himself to Professor Alber's erroneous data on Hawaii, he now refused to condone what Yale had done to his favorite Hawaiian editor, James Jackson Jarvis. Yale had stolen the pictures, and Hawksworth bluntly reiterated his charges. And then, late one afternoon, as he walked disconsolately through the collection, a completely new thought came to him. It really doesn't matter to Jarvis now whether Yale stole the pictures or not, just as it doesn't matter whether the missionaries stole the land or not. What counts, and the only thing that counts, is this: what good did the institution accomplish? If Yale had not picked up the pictures, forcibly perhaps, where would they be now? Could they possibly have served the wonderful purposes they serve here in New Haven? If the missionaries had stepped aside and allowed Hawaii to drift from one degeneracy to another, what good would have been accomplished? Yale is better by far for having had such a solid beginning for its art school, and Hawaii is better for having had the missionaries. The minor blemishes on the record are unimportant. It doesn't matter what an arrogant fool like Albers says. Janders and the rest were right to ignore him. The fact is that in Hawaii today there are sugar plantations and pineapple and deep reservoirs and a lot of different people living together reasonably well. If Yale stole the pictures, they're entitled to them because of the good use to which they put them. And I'm not going to argue with anyone anymore about the missionaries stealing Hawaii. If they did, which I don't admit, they certainly put what they stole to good purposes. He saw then, that gloomy afternoon when he was being hammered by his friends, that there were many ways to judge the acts of an institution, and the pragmatic way was not the worst by any means. Thus he started his education, that marvelous, growing, aching process whereby a mind develops into a usable instrument with a collection of proved experience from which to function. And he was suddenly tired of Yale and Punahou men and professors trained at Leipzig, and problems relating to James Jackson Jarvis.